Sometimes there would be a perfect green cake or a fresh loaf of bread in the bag. I've always believed that the man who ran the restaurant guessed what the story was and deliberately put these in. At one stage we were deeply in arrears with the loan on the cottage and in danger of losing our home if we didn't pay. I went to the social welfare office to see if they could give any help above the disability pension that was being provided. Joe came with me. Although Joe was seriously ill, they didn't believe our story. They queried, was he really sick, despite the medical certificates. They said they believed he could have worked if he truly wanted to. After Joe died, the woman in the social welfare office apologized to me. In desperation, we put part of the garden up for sale. On reflection, it's clear that I was so desperate to make life a little more comfortable for Joe that I sold it for considerably less than it was worth. It did, however, allow me to clear some of our debts. You lose your dignity when you have to beg, but sometimes there is no choice, particularly when there is a family involved. One of the symptoms of Joe's sickness was that he was always cold, even in summer he would be shivering. I went again to the social welfare, looking for money to buy him thermal underwear. Again, they said nothing was wrong and refused to help. What frustrated and upset me was that I could see many other families being given financial support. I think the fact that we lived in our own cottage, tiny as it was, rather than a council house, influenced them, as did the fact that Joe, with his pride, always tried to look well and respectable when he went to see them. My angels kept telling me to go to a local charity. I fiercely resisted. I was tired of losing my dignity. Why would they believe me if the social welfare didn't? Eventually things got so desperate that I rang them and made an appointment to see them. I went to see the charity and explained our circumstances. They sent a man to visit the cottage, to inspect us. The man walked around the cottage slowly, looking at everything, opening cupboards. He then turned to me and announced, "If you have a bag of potatoes and a tin of beans, then your family won't go hungry. You're not in need of our help." I tried to explain about the dietary needs of a celiac, how Christopher needed a special diet to grow, otherwise there was a danger he would be permanently stunted. In fact, at 7 years old he weighed only 2.5 stone, when he should have weighed at least 4. I explained how Joe's sickness meant that there were a lot of foods that he just couldn't keep down. But the man didn't seem interested in hearing. I'm sure he believed he was right. In the end, the charity gave us little bits of support, but much of it was no use. They would drop in free vouchers for particular foods, but invariably it would be a food that Christopher and Joe couldn't eat. One Christmas we got a voucher for a turkey, and we were very pleased about that. But when I went down to collect it, the humiliation of the experience took all the good away. The committee was the calling out names as people came forward to collect their turkeys. When they called my name, they said, "Oh yes, you." I felt they had been talking about me, and they believed we were chancing it, taking food out of the mouths of those who really did need it. Little did they know. One day I ran into Sean, a man I had known from the prayer group in Maynooth. We no longer went to the prayer group as getting there was too much for Joe. I missed it, both the praying together and the company of the people who we met there. In fact, at this time I went out little late to do the shopping, to collect the children from school, to work the odd time I had a job for a few hours, but nowhere else. Joe's health was so unpredictable that I was afraid to leave him on his own for even a short time. Sean was now a member of the local charity committee, and soon after I'd run into him he called in one day to have a cup of tea with me. Sitting at the kitchen table I told him the truth of our circumstances. He was the only person I ever told the full extent of our financial difficulties. Sean was devastated, and he promised to get more help from the charity for us. It wasn't that easy, though. When Sean raised our case with the committee, they fought hard against giving us help and eventually refused his request. I know that this was the work of the devil. Sometimes Satan makes it more difficult for us to do what we are meant to do. On some occasions the forces of evil try to frustrate us in our lives and the work that we are doing, making life harder for us than it might be otherwise. Sometimes it's in quite subtle ways, such as distracting us away from something we're supposed to do. I know this is one of the reasons that I received so little help with my family when Joe was sick. In this case, the devil was blinding the people to the circumstances in front of them. I am in a constant battle with the devil. When someone has a very strong faith, the devil tries to make it difficult and frequently succeeds in the short term, but I know that no matter how hard the evil forces of Satan tried to frustrate the work, God and the angels always win in the end. Sean found it very hard to believe that he couldn't get more help for us. He was allowed to bring us some vouchers for food, and he was distraught when he realized how little good they were to us, given the dietary requirements. Sean took a detailed list of the foods Joe and Christopher could eat, and every so often after that he would bring us a small bag of groceries. I'm sure he was paying for these out of his own wallet. As time went on, more and more people heard about me and came to see me for help. One woman who came to see me about this time was a grandmother, not very old, but a grandmother nonetheless. She was called Mary. About 10 years previously, one of her neighbors had given birth to twins, one of whom died shortly after birth. Mary told me that even when the mother was pregnant, although she was not a close friend or a relation, she felt drawn to the babies. She couldn't quite understand it. When Mary first saw the baby, Josie, in the cot, she knew there was a connection, a bond, even before she reached into the cot to touch her little face. Many of us have heard the phrase soulmate, and we tend to think of it mainly as a romantic concept, as the perfect partner, perhaps someone to marry. But one must remember that a soulmate could be a child in the same way as it could be an adult. People go around searching for their soulmate, but he or she may be in another part of the world. It may be that person you send a few euros to help, that man in a wheelchair, the child with Down's syndrome you've just passed by in the street. Anyone could be your soulmate. As Josie grew, Mary continued to be very close to her. Anytime that child was sick or in trouble, Mary would instinctively know. And it was the same for Josie, too. At times, the child would tell her mother that she needed to go and see Mary, and when her mother asked why, she always got the same answer, "I know Mary needs me." Her mother didn't always allow Josie to go to see Mary when she asked, because sometimes it might be dark, or lashing rain, but Josie would keep asking until she was eventually allowed to go. Josie would arrive at Mary's hall door, knock and say, "Mary, what's the matter?" Mary would just look at the little girl and think, "My God, she knows that I'm feeling sad today." They were soulmates, different ages, the same sex, but soulmates nonetheless. Soulmates have a very special connection to each other. Each knows how the other is feeling. Mary is dead now. Sometime before she died, she said to me, "I know Josie is my soulmate, I knew it wasn't my husband." It was an understanding that she came to, towards the end of her own life. Mary's death had an enormous effect on Josie, whom I had also got to know. When Mary died, she felt as if a huge piece of her heart had been taken away. It's very possible that Josie will meet another soulmate during her life, as there can be more than one during a lifetime. I believe that sometimes we miss our soulmate because we don't recognize him or her, we are too busy. But that doesn't mean that the other person doesn't recognize us. We also all have to learn that we can love someone and cherish them and give our lives for them, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are our soulmates. It's so sad to see young people, or not so young people, who say, "I won't settle until I meet my soulmate." As soon as they say that, they are putting a big block on finding someone who may not be their soulmate, but who may be able to bring them considerable happiness. You needn't search for that person, because if your soulmate is to pass through your life, then they will, whether it is for a brief moment or a longer time. I remember watching the news with Joe one night. There was a report of a horrific train crash in the UK. I had noticed a picture of this in the paper earlier in the day, but had avoided it. Yet I knew, somehow, there was something I was supposed to see. I should have known better, though. When God and the angels want to show me something, I can't avoid it. There was film of a man on a stretcher, surrounded by rescue workers. I have no idea who the man was, other than that he was a survivor of that train crash, but I do know that, whoever he was, he had just met his soulmate on that train and that his soulmate was now dead. I knew this because I was allowed to see the contact between them. As he was being carried on the stretcher, he reached up with his arm and I know he was able to see the soul of his soulmate. I was allowed to see that his soulmate was comforting him, making sure he survived. I wasn't allowed to know what gender the soulmate had been, or whether he or she was young or old, but I know it was his soulmate and that they had met only fleetingly. I remember feeling terribly sad and thinking, oh my God, I hate this. Actually, hate is the wrong word. I felt such pain as I was watching and such compassion for the pain and loss the man on the stretcher was feeling, seeing his soulmate as he reached out for that brief instant. I don't know whether he would remember he had fleetingly met his soulmate. Sometimes spiritual things happen when we are in a state of pain and shock. Afterwards, we wonder if it really did happen. Did we see something, or was it just a flash of light? Around this time I became very conscious of the connection between myself and a man who had murdered his wife. No matter where I went or what I was doing, this connection would appear in some way. I'd turn on the radio and hear something about the murder, I'd be walking down the road, and somehow would come across a newspaper, maybe even on the ground as I was walking past. The print would stand out, as if it were rising from the paper, and the only thing I would see in that newspaper would be something about this horrific murder. One evening, I went into the front room and turned on the television. The late news was on. I went to turn it off, but the television wouldn't turn off. I heard one of my angels say, "Lorna, sit down and watch the news." Reluctantly, I did so. I looked at the television and I saw a film of the man who had just been found guilty of murdering his young wife in a very cold, calculated, and premeditated way. As I was sitting watching it, I was shown what he had done to his soul. He had disconnected his own human self from his soul, so that his soul couldn't interfere with what he planned to do. This had put coldness, ice, into his heart. It's hard to explain, but it was as if he had pushed his soul away, away back from him, and had then chained his soul as if to a wall, with chains that couldn't be broken. Sometimes we do these things to our soul because we want greed to rule our lives. We become obsessed with material things. It wasn't the devil, or anyone else who had done this to this man's soul. He had done it himself. He had become, in a sense, a man of ice. That is how he was at that moment. I was allowed to see his soul as he was being led off to jail. This doesn't mean that over time that he might not feel remorse and his soul might break some of the chains. He'll never be able to bring back the girl, his young wife whom he murdered, and he has to pay, humanely, for what he has done. But the worst part of all is what he has done to his own soul. This is the worst. As his soul breaks free, if he allows it, he will go through terrible torment within himself. He will try to avoid feeling it, but eventually he will break down and then he will feel deep and terrible pain. This man had deliberately gone out and killed for reasons of greed. He had planned to take the soul from someone else's body. He had taken this soul before its time. I know some would say that if you are murdered, then it had to be your time, or it had to be retribution for an act in a past life, but this is not always true. He took her soul and his soul felt tremendous pain and hurt. His soul felt this because it was not able to stop him performing this terrible act. Her soul, that of his young murdered wife, also feels the sadness of knowing that his soul is trapped. Her soul forgives him. Souls always forgive. It's as if souls never give up. They are like the angels. One soul never gives up on another. Chapter 24, Peace in Ireland and at Christmas. One Monday evening, Joe was watching the news on television and he called out to me to come quickly. On the screen was a picture of the pawnbroker shop in Dublin which we used. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Thieves had broken into the shop over the weekend and everything had been cleared out. The theft hadn't been discovered until Monday morning, and the Garda were saying they had no idea who had done it, but that it had been well planned. I turned to Joe and looked at him, saying, "That means my ring has gone." I started to cry. My beautiful ring. I was very upset. Joe put his arm around me. "Now we won't have it to get us out of a jam anymore. It's just not fair," I said. I felt lost without my ring. It meant an awful lot to me, even though, being honest, it spent more time in the pawnbroker's than on my finger. I hoped that maybe the police would recover the ring, but as time went on that seemed more and more unlikely. A few weeks later, we got a letter in the post from the pawnbrokers. Joe must have read it about 4 times for me. It notified us that the receipt we signed at the pawnbrokers, when we left the ring in, released them of any responsibility. They had no liability at all for the theft of the ring when in their care. We were gutted by this. No ring and no compensation for its loss. Joe promised that someday he would get me another ring. I told him it didn't matter, that no ring would mean the same to me as that one. Joe gave me another hug and we put the letter away. A few days later, while sitting on the doorstep of the cottage, Angel Michael appeared as if walking around from the back of the house. He sat beside me on the doorstep. "I don't feel like talking," I said to him. Angel Michael put his hand on my shoulder. "Lorna, I'm very sorry about your ring. We could do nothing." I turned to Michael and his radiance made me smile a little. "Michael, I just wish you could have done something," I said. "Joe is sad too. He feels he has let me down. He said the other day that if he had been able to provide for us better, then the ring would never have been in the pawnbroker's. Remember, Lorna," Michael said, "it's only a ring, a material object. Just remember Joe's love." I thought about what Michael had said for a minute. He was right, of course. I felt much better. I turned and smiled at Michael and then he disappeared. I didn't give much more thought to the ring after that. I'm not interested in politics, but I'm very interested in peace, and at this time, in the mid-1990s, there was a lot of talk about peace in Northern Ireland. I asked Angel Michael about Northern Ireland on one occasion when he was sitting with me. He told me people would try and scupper the peace process. It was unlikely they would succeed, but peace would be a long time coming. It would take 20 years or so before everything was sorted out. Since then I have been watching and watching. I've noticed lately how some people have become considerably more open and giving, being forced to retreat from previous positions to bring about peace. Michael told me that it's very important that peace comes to Northern Ireland. It's not just important for Ireland and Great Britain. If a terrorist group like the IRA can become part of a government, it will show terrorist groups in other countries that they can do it too, that there is a route to peace other than by violence. I have been told that Ireland can be a cornerstone for peace in the world. The devil is constantly trying to remove it, but it is turned around again and again. Ireland is an example of religion fighting religion, faith fighting faith, and if Ireland can come to peace, so can other countries. It will even have influence on Iraq, Palestine and Israel. I have been shown different paths for the world. At times I have watched and been terrified. Some of the possible futures I have been shown have been truly atrocious, and if one of those come to pass I don't want to be alive to see it. But I have also been shown many wonderful paths, where there is room for everyone to live in harmony and at peace. I believe the world in the future can be a wonderful place, but every single individual has to play their part. All ordinary people want peace. A woman who lived in Northern Ireland came to see me. Her husband had been killed in the violence and her elder son was now in jail for his role as a terrorist. It broke her heart to see how her elder son had destroyed his life and all the pain he had caused to others. Her younger son was now following in his brother's footsteps, and she feared he would end up dead too. She could see no end to this cycle of violence. Every day she went to the church to pray for peace and to pray for a normal life, so that her elder son could come back and be a father to his young child, and that her younger son could marry and have children. She told me she was fed up of going to funerals and was determined not to pass on hatred day, but she saw other grandmothers who were actively doing so. If those grandmothers would stop breathing hatred into their children and their grandchildren, it would make a very big difference, she said. She was trying, but it wasn't at all easy. My heart went out to her. As I have said before, the angels have told me that war is easy, making and keeping peace is the difficult thing. I had become very anxious about Joe in recent months. I could see him deteriorating, he was losing weight and constantly having stomach problems, and his body seemed to be shriveling up. I called the doctor frequently, but he didn't seem to be able to do anything. One day when Joe was at home in bed, he became extremely ill and disorientated. He didn't know who he was, or who I was. He was in great distress and I was terrified I was going to lose him. When he came around, Joe found he couldn't move the left side of his body, and his speech was slurred. Joe had had a stroke. They kept him in hospital for months, doing intensive physiotherapy and teaching him to walk and speak again. For a long time after this he dragged his leg, and I used to have to cut up his food because he couldn't hold his fork properly. Fortunately, after a period his speech came back to normal, and you couldn't hear the stroke in his voice. Sometimes when Joe was back at home recuperating, we would go for a walk in the evening when it was dark. Joe was embarrassed to be seen, he thought people would think he was drunk. I used to tell him that it didn't matter what other people thought, and I walked with my arm around him, although he was a very tall man and I'm a small woman. The angels helped me, as I wouldn't have been able to support Joe on my own. Joe had a habit of pushing me out to the edge of the footpath and, but for the angels, I know we would have fallen. I gave out to God and the angels constantly about Joe, asking, why does he have to be ill? Why can't you make him better? Why can't you make life easier? One day I was in tears out in the garden, pretending to be doing something so that no one would see my tears. Angel Michael appeared in front of me. I almost stepped into him as I reached up to pull a leaf off the plum tree. I sobbed at him, Michael, I don't want to believe that Joe's life is coming to an end. It's too soon. Please tell God. I don't think I could cope. I don't want Joe to die. Lorna, God can hear you, Michael replied. He knows what is in your heart. Lorna, look at me, look into my eyes. What do you see? As I looked into the angel Michael's eyes, everything seemed to vanish, even angel Michael. His eyes turned into a pathway full of life and light. On each side of the pathway I could see snow white angels, and there was Joe as a young man, healthy and strong, walking with angels, walking towards members of his family who had already died. Joe was on the pathway to heaven. Seeing Joe looking so well and happy filled my heart with joy. At the same time, I cried out, Angel Michael, no! No! I don't want Joe to die. He's too young to die. He's only in his early 40s. It's not fair. I stood under the plum tree crying my heart out, with Michael comforting me, his feathered wings wrapped around me and his arms holding me tight. After a while Michael unfolded his wings from around me and wiped the tears from my eyes. Lorna, be strong now, go and take care of your family and Joe. Angel Michael touched my forehead and in a flash of light he was gone. A few weeks later, I was asked by a friend to see a family the following evening. I was a little hesitant about seeing them because of Joe and because the children would be home from school, with dinner, sports, homework and all that going on in that small house. I was a little reluctant to agree, but I did. The next evening, to my surprise, Joe got up for dinner and decided he would go and visit a friend with Christopher. I kept looking at Joe. His soul seemed to be one step in front of him all the time. I was really frightened and told him he needn't go out, that I could see the family in the kitchen. Joe said that he felt he shouldn't be there when the family was visiting, and not to worry as Christopher would be with him. A knock came at the door. The family had arrived early. Joe and Christopher passed the visitors in the hall. Just as the family were leaving, Joe arrived back and again they passed each other in the hall. I said goodbye at the front door and, when I came back into the kitchen, Joe looked extremely pale and seemed a little agitated. I put the kettle on straight away, made tea and put about 4 spoonfuls of sugar into it for him. I insisted he sit down and drink it immediately. I made a sandwich and poured him another cup of tea. As I stood at the opposite end of the table, watching him, I asked, "Are you sure you are feeling okay?" "I'm fine," he replied, "there's no need to fuss." He could only have taken about 2 bites out of the sandwich when the atmosphere changed in the room. At that moment, Ruth, in night clothes and bare feet, opened the kitchen door and asked, "Mum, can I ring a friend about homework?" I looked from Ruth to Joe and then back to Ruth. "Yes, but be quick," I replied. Everything happened in slow motion. The only sound to be heard was Ruth was dialing the number and the clicking sound of the dial, then her voice saying hello. Then it happened. Joe took an extremely bad turn. I had always done my best never to allow the children to see this happening. Ruth started screaming hysterically as her dad went into convulsions. I was trying to help Joe and my daughter at the same time. I knew Joe was dying and I needed help. I cried silently, "Angels, help," as I said to Ruth, "Go and get Christopher." It turned out that Christopher had gone to the shops and wasn't there to help. I told Ruth to dial 999, ask for an ambulance and give our address. Ruth spoke hysterically to someone on the other end of the phone line. When she had done this, I told her to go quickly and fetch a neighbor to help. Ruth ran out the door screaming, still barefoot. I was standing beside Joe, holding on to him and praying. I was doing all I could to help him physically, holding him as he sat slumped at the kitchen table. No sooner had Ruth gone out the door than there was a flash of light. Joe and I, sitting at the table in the center of the room, became encased in what looked like an enormous ice cube or cube of crystal. The cube was hollow in the center and extremely cold. I could see my breath, yet I felt warm. There was no breath coming from Joe's mouth. He had stopped breathing and his lips were going blue. I cried out, "Angels, I am not prepared for this." Snow White angels walked into the cube. I screamed and cried, "No, God. Please don't take Joe yet. Let him stay in this world a little longer." I watched with great pain in my heart as Joe's soul moved out of his body completely and the path that Angel Michael had shown me appeared. I could see Joe as I had seen him before. His soul radiant, beautiful angels walking with him and, in the distance further down the path, members of his family waiting to welcome him. As he walked towards them, I was still asking God to please let Joe stay in this world for a little longer, for him not to die just yet, that I still needed him and so did the children. I suddenly felt great warmth as God's voice spoke, "Lorna, I will give him back to you only this once, but you must never ask again." God spoke with a firm voice. I knew he was being stern with me for asking for something I should not have asked for. I felt like I had as a child when an adult was cross with me. God spoke with such power of authority that I knew I should not have asked. God's words stayed in my mind constantly from then on, "I must never ask again." Suddenly Joe's body sat up. He opened his mouth and it was as if life was sucked back into his human body. As his soul re-entered his body, the life force was unbelievable. It was only then that I had noticed that it was Joe's guardian angel who had sat him up. Joe turned to me and spoke in a whispered voice, "I think I was on my way to heaven." Then he seemed to pass out. Only then did I become aware of the sound of Ruth and our neighbor rushing in through the hall door and, at the same time, heard Christopher's and Owen's voices calling out, "What's wrong?" as they ran up the drive. When the ambulance arrived, it took a little convincing to get Joe to go to the hospital. Eventually, though, he went and I followed with a neighbor in a car. Some hours later, a doctor came out to speak to me and told me that Joe was very lucky. He had been in a coma when he had arrived at the hospital. "Joe must have someone watching over him," the doctor said, as he turned around and walked away. I smiled because I, of course, knew he did have someone watching over him, ah, his guardian angel, lay, and that God had granted the miracle and given him back his life. Joe spent 2 weeks in hospital. I was constantly thanking God for that miracle of giving Joe back for another little while. I didn't know how much time we had together, whether it was weeks, months, or maybe another couple of years.